Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about the preservation of cultural heritage. And here, we're talking about, potentially, a range of things. We could be talking about a building or a monument, a work of art. Could even be talking about something more portable like a language. Those things that are all very important for groups to preserve their group identity. And for that reason, perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that sometimes if one is interested in attacking a group, in breaking it up, in controlling it, that you would attack those very things, those very aspects of cultural heritage, which leads to the question, is there something that can be done internationally by international bodies to preserve cultural heritage? In this first hour of the show, our guest is William Logan. He's been involved in cultural heritage conservation for quite a long time and has been engaged now for a number of years in teaching and research and consulting on both Australian and Asian heritage issues. He's on the faculty at Deakin University, and that's in Melbourne. He holds the UNESCO Chair of Heritage and Urbanism in the School of Social and International Studies there. Since 1986, he's been an international expert for the UNESCO Division of Cultural Heritage in Paris, where his work has mainly been related to UNESCO's international campaigns to safeguard world cultural heritage sites in a number of places, including Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Vietnam. He's also director of the Cultural Heritage Center for Asia and the Pacific, a research and training center that has been endorsed by UNESCO. And he's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to take part in an international workshop looking at issues of cultural heritage protection. And he will be giving a talk dealing with some of these issues on the U of I campus this afternoon. This is part of the MillerCom series, the title Closing Pandora's Box, Human Rights Conundrums in Cultural Heritage Protection. That's 4 o'clock this afternoon in the Plym Auditorium at Temple Hoyne Buell Hall on Taft Drive in Champaign. All of these events, they're always free and open to the public, so anyone who is interested certainly should feel free to stop by and hear him talk. And here on the program, questions are welcome, too. The only thing we ask of people who call in is they just try to be brief so that we can keep the program going and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who's listening is welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Good morning, David.
I appreciate it. To make sure that people know what it is we're talking about, give some examples. So what sort of things would come under the heading of cultural heritage?
Well, the way I try to define it is all those things that generally we're proud of that come to us from previous generations. We're so proud of them, we want to pass them on to future generations. Sometimes these can be what we call tangible heritage. So this is buildings and places and monuments, archaeological sites. But more recently, there's been a lot of interest in intangible heritage. So this is song and dance and music and language and all the skills that are in arts, art forms that are embodied in people. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, of course, it can also be things that we're not so proud of, but which we want to keep because they provide good lessons of, you know, what societies ought not to do in the future.
Yeah.
So you think of genocide sites and sometimes prisons and things like that. So it's a very wide range of things.
Yeah. The things we're talking about have always been lost. Sometimes it seems just to happen. Other times it's a matter of intent. It's deliberate. I'm sure that there are countless examples of times within a particular country, one group emerges victorious over another and wants to wipe away any signs of the previous. One country conquers another and they go in and probably the first thing you do is you tear down the temples or you take your gods and install them there. These things, we've certainly seen them before. Having said that, do you think that now here recently this is any more serious a problem? Is it any more acute now than it has ever been in human history?
Well, there have been a lot of conflicts since the end of the Cold War that seem to be culture-based, you know, where people are trying to break away from larger groups. You think of Central Asia, and you know, in those cases, culture is at the very center of this, and the identity, and so on. If you think of Chechnya, trying to break away from Russia, mm-hmm. based around culture. So these sorts of things seem to be just as bad as they were before. And the breakup of Yugoslavia, another one where, you know, cultural heritage was very deliberately targeted. This was the strategy, you know, the bombing, the destruction of the archives in Sarajevo's library and so on. These were not accidents. They were very deliberate strategy to try and undermine the morale and the identity of the enemy.
What about, I could imagine a case where a government, for example, might be involved in doing something like this. And perhaps here we're talking about an internal matter, so it's within the borders of a particular country. And that the government would say, it would at least seem to be on the face of it, that the government would have a reasonably positive intent. So perhaps the government will say, well, you know, here we have a country where we have many different groups of people. That they're disparate. They have different cultures. They have different languages. They have different ways. And we think that it's important for the success of this country for everyone to feel that they're one people and that they're part of one nation. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do to see if we can foster that is, for example, we're going to say we're going to pick one language. We're going to say everybody's going to speak that language. The schools are going to teach it. And we're going to do what we can to discourage people from speaking other languages. And I suppose you can imagine different ways we could go forward from that and saying different sorts of things. We're going to say we have a unified culture here. We're expecting everybody to embody this culture. And we're going to sanction people if they don't. What's wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that? I mean, at one level, of course, you do want people to have opportunities in the workplace and so on, and so you may need to have a language that everybody uses in the workplace, but that doesn't mean that in the home and in the church and so on that you also have to use it. So these days we would argue that it's part of people's human rights that they can maintain their culture. And governments need to develop policies that are not so directly assimilationist, but are more multicultural, that allow these sorts of things to coexist alongside the mainstream language. But in many countries, I mean, you think of, Myanmar, for instance, to use an example, there you've got the use of cultural heritage protection programs where they're singling out Buddhist buildings, particularly mainstream Buddhist buildings, and trying to marginalize the cultural heritage of the Karen and the Mon people and so on. Now, this is not a benign program. You know, this is straight assimilation, and it's an attempt to force the minorities to abandon their cultures and to take on the mainstream Burmese culture.
Yeah. Well, I would say my example, I'm trying to make it sound as benign as I possibly could, as obviously it can be anything but, and there are some examples. I guess I'm interested in perhaps you could give some other examples or maybe present a case study of something where an instance where people were deliberately being punished simply for expressing their culture and their cultural values.
Well, there are lots in the past and in countries that we regard as quite enlightened these days or even then. In France, for instance, there was a very strongly assimilationist policy which was directed against the minority groups within the boundaries of France. So an area that I've studied quite a lot is Brittany, where the Breton language is a Celtic language. It's not a Romance language. And where people there were not allowed to use their language, they were not allowed to use Breton names, because in France there was a list of acceptable names that you could register your child under. And then, this went along with trying to mainstream the Breton population through occupations like, through the army for men and through domestic service in Paris for women and so on. Now, that kind of approach, of course, usually gets some reaction, and this was a fairly violent one for a while, but eventually the policy has changed, where now you have schooling and universities teaching in Breton and so on. So it takes the steam out, and by allowing people to maintain their cultural rights. Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, that's an example. Vietnam, another country that I know very well, also ran a strongly assimilationist line, because they have over 50 ethnic groups, depends a bit how you count them, but so well over 50 ethnic groups, mainly in the mountains, but there's also the Chinese ethnic group within Vietnam. And the early attempts were always to assimilate those people, to get them down out of the mountains, to, you know, to go through schooling that would be in Vietnamese, and the dominant group, the King Viet. That's softened a lot in recent years. The last 10, 15 years, there's been a tendency to allow them to maintain some of those cultural aspects. But still, you know, there is an expectation that they will learn Vietnamese and use the mainstream Vietnamese language in normal interaction with the rest of the people in Vietnam. So there is there's a kind of shift going on there.
Well, if indeed that happens, if you see in a place a shift from this kind of extreme, this feeling that's a sort of extreme assimilation is the kind of way that should go, to a point where you at least have some sort of tolerance and appreciation for the idea of cultural diversity. What happens to, particularly, I guess I'm thinking among the people who run the country, what happens to their attitudes? How is it that they become persuaded that perhaps at least some level of diversity is not a threat? And that they might say, well, maybe we can be a little bit more relaxed about this kind of attitude that we've had towards everybody being the same.
Well, it's partly driven by the people who are saying that, you know, that that they do in many cases resist in quite violent ways. So a pragmatic response to that is not to, you know, a good pragmatic response is not to send in the armies and try and keep these people under control in that way, but to change the social policy and educational policies that accommodate these different cultures. There's also a lot of pressure on governments from the kind of discourse that's going on globally, where since the Second World War and the 1940s, there have been a number of charters and conventions and declarations and so on that are talking about these issues of human rights and cultural diversity. And so this does provide a situation where governments can lose face if they're not coming into line with those sorts of ideas. Mm-hmm. So it's happening from both directions, really, from globally but also coming locally.
Let me introduce again for our guest for this part of Focus 580, William Logan. He's the UNESCO Chair of Heritage and Urbanism at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia, and is very much involved in cultural heritage conservation, has been for a number of years. And he is here to take part in a conference talking about these issues here on the U of I campus, an international workshop, and we'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 dealing with some of these kinds of issues. Here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We've touched on what, as I'm sure, one of the difficult issues, and that is that if you were, say, if you represent some sort of an international effort to advance the idea that cultural heritage is worthy of protection, that in particular cases, I'm sure you run up against the issue of national sovereignty. That is, the governments would say, well, that's all well and good, but it's none of your business. Essentially, that what we're doing here in our country is our business, and this is what we think is best for us, and please go away and don't bother us. And if indeed that you think that this is something that's important, what do you do about it?
Well, we've had a case of this recently in Australia, where in the Northern Territory there is a national park called Kakadu, which is a wetland area with a lot of rock art from indigenous people. It was put onto the World Heritage List back in the 1980s as a natural heritage site, later re-inscribed as a cultural site because it was recognised that, as the indigenous people in Australia do, you can't separate from the nature from culture. I mean, it was just totally bound up. So it was re-inscribed in that way. But in the middle of this site, there is an area that is not part. It's a little exclave, an area that's not part of the World Heritage Site. And the reason for that is that there's uranium there and uranium mining. And this was negotiated with the local indigenous people, the Marah tribe, back in the 1980s. Since then, there have been a lot of changes. That tribal leader has gone and his daughter has taken over. But there's also been some leakages of uranium waste into the water, into this wetland area. So you've got a potential, you know, problem. Now, the government didn't respond particularly well to notification of these problems. Certainly that's how the Marah people saw it. So eventually they went off directly to UNESCO, to the World Heritage Committee in Paris, which is not what you should do. You know, normally the protocol is that you go through the government, because this is an international government organization, UNESCO, so you're dealing with governments. But this caused an almighty uproar in Australia. You had the government very concerned because it feared a huge compensation damages claim if uranium mining was stopped. Some of the customers said they would not continue to buy uranium if this place went onto the World Heritage in Danger list and so on. The government then was seen as backing the miners, and UNESCO was placed in this very difficult position of having to send in a team of experts to see whether, in fact, uranium was threatening the natural values and the cultural values of the area. The Australian government took the view that this was interference in the internal affairs of the country. Now, I mean, my own view on that is that Australia has signed the World Heritage Convention and it needs to accept all the conditions of that. You can't just take on the World Heritage inscription and use this to attract more tourists. And, you know, you can't just take the benefits. There are also the responsibilities that come along with this. So it's forced UNESCO to try and sort out some of the contradictions and ambiguities in its own convention, in fact, where it was not at all clear whether you needed to have the prior approval of a government before you could put a place onto the World Heritage List, or whether you could go in. Now, the problem was that if you said you had to have the government's prior approval, then it takes all the teeth out of that convention. Mm-hmm. So they called in the lawyers, and this went on through many bitter debates in UNESCO, and eventually it was decided that you didn't need the government's prior approval. So the Australians were not at all pleased with that. But, you know, that's the situation at the present time. Mm-hmm. Another case of the same sort of thing was in Nepal, where the Kathmandu Valley, there's a number of sites in the Kathmandu Valley are on the World Heritage List as well, but there you've got a problem of massive urbanisation and buildings now really encroaching upon the temples and so on, which are the basis of the inscription. The Nepalese government always said, we object to this going onto the World Heritage in Danger list. So nothing was happening. Once it was clarified that you could put something on this in danger list without the government's approval, then that happened. And Kathmandu is now on the in danger list. Now, the point about the in danger list is that this directs the attention focuses government on actually doing something about it. In many cases, governments are happy to have things go on the in danger list. It's not always that kind of confrontation. Mm-hmm. For instance, yes, one of your parks was put on the in danger list with the approval of your government, Yosemite, I think, but. And that issue has been sorted out and solved, and it's come off that list again, you see. So it's just a way of focusing attention on the problem and getting something done about it.
Yeah, but it sounds as if that maybe the chief weapon that you would have against a government would simply be to embarrass them. make them look bad.
That's right. That's right. I mean, UNESCO is an IGO, an international government organization. So you're dealing with sovereign states. You know, UNESCO can't override those except under very exceptional circumstances, and this turns out to be one of them.
Yeah. And also, it's interesting, though, that with that kind of example that you gave, the example that you gave, it now makes me start to think that maybe in some cases the threat against cultural heritage, before I was thinking, well, that maybe this was something that was the result of a sort of a deliberate government policy, that there was a sense of political motivation behind it. Now, this makes me think that, in fact, some cases maybe what we're talking about here is private interests within a country that have commercial motivations, and that it's really that it's not so much about wanting to control people through manipulating or controlling, destroying culture. It's somebody's desire to make a buck, and that's the thing that may indeed be driving some of it. And it's not really about politics so much as it's about economics.
Well, that's true. It depends what kind of regime you're talking about. I mean, Vietnam, it's much more a government approach because often it's an economic development, but it has government backing. If you're talking about the US or Australia, then it is, you know, it's private interests very often that are behind this.
Yeah. That would be if we were talking about Yosemite, that would be my guess that it would be something like that, that people were concerned about people who were interested in exploiting the resource for gain, and the concern that in fact, if that happens, that kind of thing gets out of control, you end up losing the resource or compromising
That's
the resource.
Right. That's right. And to put something on the endanger list also gives us a negative signal to tourists. So you get the tourism interest coming in wanting to sort these things out. So tourism can be a good and a bad thing. I mean, often the intense pressure that you get on these sites because it's inscribed as a World Heritage List can be damaging to the site. But on the other hand, that industry has an interest in making sure that the place survives, that there's a sustainability element in it.
How many sites are on the list now?
It's 700, 800.
Oh,
the question is, where do you stop? Yeah. And that's now the new list that's come in with the Convention on Intangible Cultural Heritage in 2003. The other one to do with places is 1972, so that's been around a while. But we now have this new one where they're putting places that represent intangible cultural heritage, and a new list will start forming for that.
Hmm. Just real quick, give me an example of something like that.
Well, one place that is put on a kind of temporary list before that convention came in, they started already drawing up a series of proclamations of intangible cultural heritage. One that went on last year were the Thai Gong culture in Vietnam. I mean, this is one of the minority groups I was referring to before in the central highlands of Vietnam. They have a very ancient culture using big brass gongs and dances associated with that. And so that has been singled out by the Vietnamese government and nominated for inscription on this as a proclamation. Now, those proclamations will eventually become the basis of this new list under the recent convention.
We are at our midpoint. We have a caller we'll get right to. I would again like to introduce the guest with this part of Focus 580, William Logan. He's from Australia. He is on the faculty of Deakin University. That's in Melbourne, where he holds the UNESCO Chair of Heritage and Urbanism in the School of Social and International Studies. Since 1986, he's been an international expert for the UNESCO Division of Cultural Heritage in Paris, where his work has been mainly related to the effort to preserve world cultural heritage sites, number of places, including Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Nepal, and Vietnam. He's also director of the Cultural Heritage Center for Asia and the Pacific, and has been involved in this particular issue, cultural heritage conservation, since the early 1970s. He's here visiting the campus for an international workshop discussing these issues, and we'll be talking about them this afternoon in a talk. This is in the MillerCom series, so it's free and open to anyone who would like to attend. That's this afternoon at 4 at Plym Auditorium, Temple Hoyne, Buell Hall on the U of I campus. And questions here are welcome to. We have someone here we'll get right to. Others can call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's the caller in Champaign. Line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really interesting conversation. First, I'd like to make a comment and then ask the caller a question. I myself am a tribally enrolled indigenous person. I'm Lakota and Ojibwe, and I reside here in Champaign. And to me, this whole issue of, like, world cultural heritage preservation sounds like a neo-colonialist practice. And what I mean by that is you are now making an international forum for deciding, you know, who is in charge of preservation of these cultures. And I would like to know, because from my indigenous epistemology, our cultures needed to be preserved, you know, since the colonists really landed in the United States. So I would like to know, like, how this forum addresses, and I think you touched on it briefly, issues of indigenous ownership of their own particular cultural practices. And do you have a number of indigenous people represented, you know, in UNESCO? And how do you decide over a nation state like the United States who gets ownership or who gets to say what the protocol around the preservation of a site would be? Because in the United States, when you're looking at indigenous treaty peoples, we are recognized as sovereign states as well. So I'll just hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, thanks for the call. That's complicated. Can you address
that? Yeah, but there's some basic misunderstanding of what UNESCO does. I mean, as I said, it's an IGO. It deals with sovereign states. So if something is nominated to go onto the World Heritage List, this is done by the state. I mean, this is not UNESCO going around the world saying, you know, we think this or that should be on the list. So in the case of the US, it's up to the US government to do that. And to do that, of course, it needs to sort out the internal political situation and you'd be in a position to be able to put forward a place. Then when the World Heritage Committee, which is made up of the member states, decides that something will go on the list, then it goes back to the state to manage the site. You know, the UNESCO doesn't do the management of it. UNESCO has no money. I mean, it's not a funding agency at all. It's really much more like a university in a way where it develops new ideas and new techniques for trying to do things around the world. But it's really the member state that has to do that entirely. So in the case of the US, it would be back to Washington to sort out how that was going to happen, and the ownership issue, you know, who owns the land and so on. This has to be decided by Washington. This has got nothing to do with UNESCO.
Hmm. Still, I guess you must hear from people who have this kind of concern frequently about that someone maybe still in the effort to control them is interested in telling them what they should be doing or telling them that their culture should be preserved or perhaps wanting to have some kind of control over the way in which it happens.
Well, yes, that can happen. And, you know, I'm not here to speak on behalf of UNESCO. I don't have that authority at all. But I do know in some cases UNESCO officers have been very wary about working in some countries because of suspicions about what might be the motivation behind proposals for heritage protection.
Hmm. Let's take another caller. In Urbana, this is line one.
Yes, I was wondering if you could speak about the destruction of the Bamiyan Buddhas in terms of national sovereignty and issues of authenticity, if perhaps there were now a move to replace them, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. This, if people don't remember, this was a story that got a great deal of international attention. Some monumental Buddhist sculptures in Afghanistan were destroyed by the Taliban, who said that, and as far as they were concerned, these were false idols and it was against their religious beliefs. And so they destroyed them. And there was a great concern raised around the world. People said, essentially said, please don't do this. This doesn't just belong to you. It belongs to the world. And that fell upon deaf ears. And so they were destroyed. And I suppose that gives that's, it also serves as an example of a case where there are limits to what anybody can do if in within a particular nation, whoever is running things decides that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, I mean, made more complicated by the fact that the Taliban wasn't recognized in the international scene as the government of that country. So in a technical sense, there was nobody really to be negotiating with. However, UNESCO and other agencies did send their top people in to try and sort this out, to get some reason into the situation. But all of that fell on deaf ears. It wasn't just the Bamiyan statues, but for a long time the Buddhist artifacts in the museum and so on in Kabul were being destroyed and lost, and the Bamiyan statues were the end and the biggest of this, but it was a much larger problem. And the person calling in is right. There have been some suggestions that these should be replaced now by replicas. The view seems to be at the moment in UNESCO that this would not be appropriate. What UNESCO has been doing through people like Christian Mannhardt and so on in the world, in the Division of Cultural Heritage, was to try and shore up what was there, to stabilize what was there. And then the argument about what happens next, I think, is still some way, to be resolved. The general view in the cultural heritage profession these days is that you tend not to make replicas. You try and represent what was there in other ways, but we'll see what happens in this case.
Are there any other example of another sort of a similar example of another place, say a monument, something that was and perhaps intentionally destroyed, or maybe it was just a case of something that was neglected and then there was an international effort that didn't lead to a restoration, if indeed that was possible? I mean, is there anything else that you can point to that would be a similar kind of situation?
Well, in ex-Yugoslavia, there is the Mostar Bridge, for instance, which linked the two sides that ended up warring at war with each other. A highly symbolic bridge. Now, there was a lot of discussion, a competition as to, for the new bridge that would be replaced. In the end, they decided to go pretty much for what was there before. I mean, it's not strictly exactly the same as my understanding, but it's getting pretty close to a replica. After the Second World War, of course, many of the inner cities of European cities were reconstructed to look like the cities that had been destroyed. In a sense, they're replicas. But under certain circumstances, you can argue that this is necessary, this is part of the healing process, and we do it. There are, going back into the 19th century, there are restorations that in France following the revolution, when there was massive destruction of particularly religious buildings. We actually look on some of those restorations as kind of the heritage now. Some of the stuff that Viollet-le-Duc was doing, the Notre Dame, where he put far more gargoyles on than were there before, because he was operating to what he thought Gothic buildings ought to look like. We now regard that as heritage. So, I mean, the area is very, very difficult, and there are no clear answers, and one tries to sort out what's the best in a particular time and a particular place and for particular people and their needs, and it can vary from one situation to another.
Yeah, well, I suppose that does indeed invite some interesting questions about when you have something that's really destroyed to the point where there's virtually nothing left, and then you come in and decide what you want to do a restoration, then what is it that you end up with? And is it really, is it something different? I mean, how can you ever tell yourself what we've done is we have recreated what was?
Mm. Yeah, these are very difficult questions. There are big differences in different parts of the world about what you mean by authentic. In Europe, there tends to be a view that authenticity is bound up in the materials. So if you've got the original fabric, this makes the place authentic. And the principal document that was founded, was established in the 1960s, the Venice Charter, which takes pretty much that line, you see. But in other parts of the world, the situation is different. In places like Australia, where we don't have big old archaeological sites of the European type, and where you have indigenous heritage, which is bound up in the land, you know, you need to have additional approaches. It's not as if you're saying the Venice Charter is wrong. You're just saying there are other things that you need to do. If you go to East Asia, their view is that it's not the fabric that counts, but the way in which buildings are used and the rituals that go on in it, the symbolism of the building, the skills that are involved in recreating the buildings. So in some cases with religious temples and shrines and so on, there is a periodic rebuilding, which is part of the ritual associated with the place, you see. So it's not at all the fabric. And so you can have in Japan, for instance, the recreation of buildings that haven't existed for some time. But that's not the issue. The issue for them is that they want to keep the authenticity of the practice. You know, the intangible heritage mm-hmm. is much more important. So you have to, again, take into account these differences around the world in the way the whole issue is conceived. And if you go to China, there is not so much interest in old buildings. You know, the idea that we have in Europe, for instance, that you keep old buildings as ruins, it's a kind of romantic old ruins, that doesn't work in China. There you need to show respect for the gods and ancestors and so on by keeping everything sparkling clean and new and repainted. And, you know, so there, again, there's a difference in what you think things are about. What are the important values of these places?
Well, about 10 minutes perhaps left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest William Logan. He's been involved in cultural heritage conservation for a number of years. He holds the UNESCO Chair of Heritage and Urbanism at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia, and is here visiting the campus to talk about some of these very issues. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something you just touched on very briefly back at the beginning when we started our conversation, and I'm interested in having you talk about, is efforts to preserve sites, memories that are things that perhaps people might rather forget. Prisons, concentration camps, places where people were tortured, you know, places that would be associated with points in a country's history that are among the darkest and where people would say, you know, I think it would be best if we tried to forget that, we tried to put that behind us. And now, the idea of making a place like that a kind of a monument or a museum, some people, I'm sure, would be horrified and would say, no, we don't want to do that. Give an example of something like that.
Well, there are lots of examples around. And the one that many of the listeners would already know about is Auschwitz, where, you know, this is a terribly important place, especially for the Jewish community around the world, but also for the rest of the world. I mean, this represents an extremely important lesson. Something shouldn't happen again. But against that, you know, there are other stakeholders in that part of Poland, you know, that have the view that you expressed, you know, that we need to move on from this, you know. So you have a conflict about what should happen in that area. It's extremely acute in some of these instances. In Cambodia, the attitude of the Cambodians is different. You know, it's a different kind of genocide, of course, because it was Cambodians against Cambodians. But there is a move afoot to turn some of these places into tourist parks and so on. I mean, quite horrific. So I'm interested in the way different societies respond to these places of pain and shame that they've got from the past, you know, what they think should happen to them. You know, this is an interesting question for the profession, you know, the professional workers in the cultural heritage field, but it's and also a very interesting reflection on the nature of those societies.
Well, what as an outsider, what can one say if the people there are going to take one attitude or another? I mean, I can see that you would be, you know, maybe you could, in one case you might assist if what they really were interested in was preservation. But particularly for the people who would say, you know, this is a chapter we just soon forget. And yeah. We certainly don't want to turn this horrible place into a museum. We just want it to go away.
Mm. Well, when I'm working overseas, I mean, my attitude always is that I will tell you about the experiences of other parts of the world. You know, you can do this, you can do that. But in the end, they have to decide for themselves.
Mm. Maybe you could talk about some place like that, that just where you think actually it has turned out to be a very positive sort of a thing, and that the people there would say, you know, whatever reservation they might have had, they came to the point where they realized, no, this was important, and actually we're glad that we did this.
Well, one example from Australia would be Port Arthur in Tasmania, which was a convict settlement. It was not a primary settlement. It wasn't a place that received the convicts, but it was a place where reoffending convicts who had come to Tasmania were incarcerated. Now, for many years after that, the view of the people in that area was, you know, let's close this down. And they tried to convert it into an ordinary mining town. They changed the name of the place and so on. But gradually the story has shifted around, and now it has become, a major tourist place. It's part of the Australian story, and, there's a much greater interest and pride often in among Australians if they've got convict ancestors, because they weren't, some of these were political prisoners and so on. So, the stories change over time, and we need to be careful not to sort of rush in and destroy and sweep everything away. Often you need, a little bit of distance before you can put things into a different perspective.
Yeah. Well, I know that you've done some work in Vietnam, and earlier said it was a place that you actually felt you knew pretty well. I'm sure that they've been dealing with some of these very issues. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that place particularly.
Yeah, well, I've been going to Vietnam since January 1990. And I went in to work with the town planners in Hanoi. They wanted to put in place some controls to protect the heritage. I mean, the city that had been unchanged really since the 1930s. And I've been going back ever since. But one of the buildings in Hanoi that fits into this is the prison. It's the Hoa Lo prison, or Hell's Hole is the translation of this. It was built by the French. It was the central, la maison centrale of the French police system. Then after the French left in the 1950s and during the Vietnam War, this became the place that the pilots who'd been downed were sent. And it was called the Hanoi Hilton. Mm-hmm. Your listeners will know about this. Mm-hmm. Now, this prison occupies a whole block in the center of Hanoi. So in the 1990s, there was a question of, what do you do with it? I mean, the prison was no longer really able to function as a prison, and they wanted to build new ones and, more modern ones. And there were pressures to redevelop the site, you see. So there was a big debate in Vietnam about what should happen. In the end, they have kept part of it, the main block, if you like, and the rest of it has been turned into a commercial site. It's now got two twin towers buildings on it overlooking this prison. So it's a very sort of pragmatic response to it. It's... from Vietnamese history, from a Vietnamese point of view, this is an important place because it represents, all the bitterness and the subjugation that they suffered under the French. It's important from an American point of view because this is where the pilots were and so on. So, they're trying to get the best of both worlds, the redevelopment and keeping some of these memories of painful places from the past. Not, mind you, that many Vietnamese actually visited. So, I think It's a combination of things. I mean, many Hanoians have not lived in Hanoi very long, so you know it's a fairly new city to them. They probably don't know very much of the detail of the French past. But there you are. I mean, this is a place of great pain and probably shame, and it's being turned into a museum. When you go there, it's kind of clean, and I'm sure it probably wasn't like that when the pilots were there. But anyway, there's something left to tell us that story.
Yeah. Well, then I guess we'd invite another question about, supposing that you do preserve a place like that, how do you tell the story of what happened, and how deep in the details do you go? And is there some chance that by preserving a place and kind of cleaning it up, that you might then get the impression people would go there and they would say, "Well, this doesn't look so bad. What's the you know? It was the it might actually even tend to downplay." The seriousness of what had happened there. If you don't really make a good effort to tell people, look, this, let me tell you what happened in this place.
No, that's right. And this is where you get into the field of heritage interpretation, which is, you know, a key in a way to the whole thing. You know, you want these buildings to be telling something to people. And it's difficult. You need to, bear in mind the different markets that you have. You know, there are Vietnamese people visiting a place like that, and there are the French, and there are the Americans, and then there are school children, and so on. So you need to be giving information at different levels, really, for these different markets. You need to do it in different ways. I mean, maybe you do need to clean up the places physically, you know. But there are ways that you can use video and photos and so on to also show what it was like at the time, you know, so that you're getting a more complex picture out of this. But there's a whole art in heritage interpretation. You also have to bear in mind, really, that heritage is not the same as history. Heritage is, you know, what we're choosing from the history, you know, the bits that we think, the stories we want to tell and so on. In many countries, that story is controlled by the government. So in Vietnam, you know, this is the situation. Very much the story that's being told is one that the government will approve of. So in other societies where the situation is a bit more liberal, and where the profession itself, the museologists and so on, are much more in control, you might get a more nuanced interpretation.
If even in places where governments are interested, say, in preserving cultural heritage, I'm sure that there are many places where they would say to UNESCO or to somebody from outside, well, yes, we'd like to do this, but we don't have the money to do this. And maybe there are cases where, again, if we're talking about something like a monument or a building, maybe it's in extreme sort of conditions environmental kind of conditions. In fact, you know, might make it very difficult to do that, in addition to the fact that it could be very expensive. And is UNESCO or are there other international organizations that are in a position to actually help pay the costs of trying to do this kind of thing?
Well, I said before, UNESCO doesn't have much money, which is really true. So it does have some emergency funds for places on the World Heritage List. But other sorts of campaigns and so on, they need to appeal to the international community. For places like Borobudur and Venice and so on, you know, these required contributions from the international community. The international community, since the fuel crisis really of the 1980s, 1990s, has been much less inclined to give this sort of money. So it is a problem. Essentially, you know, UNESCO is accepting the nomination from a nation state, a sovereign state, and the responsibility is on the sovereign state to do this work. So UNESCO only comes in cases of real emergency. Now, we've been talking a lot about places at the World Heritage level, but of course this is just a small part of it. Beneath that, you've got all the places that are of national significance that are on national lists. You know, this is where the national government has to find money to do it. And then in many countries like my own, you know, there is a whole raft of places that are on the local government lists. You know, so it's up to local government to find the money. So there's a danger that, you know, in focusing all the time on the UNESCO, the World Heritage level, this is really just a small part of the big problem.
Yeah. Well, just yesterday we were talking about with the author of a book who had looked at the effort to preserve a Shaker community that is located in Kentucky, a place that was actually successfully preserved, and a lot of people think that is a fine historical site. It's on a National Register of Historic Places for the United States. And the effort began back in the 60s, and at a time when there wasn't people didn't talk as much about historic preservation as they do now. And during the course of the program, someone called in from over in Indiana and said, you know, here in our community, we have a couple of little buildings. We have a church and another building we would like to preserve, but we have no idea how to go about this. We don't have any money. He said that there was a state organization that would be willing to lend them some money, but then he said, I have no idea how we would pay them back. And that shows that it probably on all levels, it's very difficult, and that at some point, the question has to be, what's it going to cost and where are we going to get the money to do it?
Yeah, that's right, especially when you're dealing, you know, with these thousands and thousands of places at the local level. Mm-hmm. Well, you always have to try and find new uses for buildings. You know, they've got to be viable. Buildings weren't built just to stand empty or to be museums. So you really, as a first strategy, is to try and find some other use for the building. Then after that, you have to look around for, you know, benefactors and other people and volunteers who can do things. I mean, I take one of my classes for the day to a building called Villa Alba in Melbourne. It's an old 19th century mansion where a group of community people have been working for 15 years to slowly restore this building. Mm-hmm. And they open it up, you know, occasionally for exhibitions, photographic exhibitions and things like that. It's a very slow process, but it gives that community something to work around, so it has an important social function within the community.
We're going to have to stop there because we're at the end of the time. I want to say thanks to our guest, William Logan, from Deakin University, Melbourne. Thank you very much.
Thank you, too.
For being here. Support for the broadcast today comes from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series at 4 o'clock Tuesday, March 14th in the Beckman Center Auditorium on the U of I campus. The Geological Survey presents a public lecture entitled Hot Water, Minerals, and Life on the Ocean Floor, What Black Smokers Tell Us, by Dr. James Franklin, consulting geologist and retired chief geoscientist for the Geological Survey of Canada.